Prepare your ears, humans. Happy, Sad, Confused begins now.
Today on Happy, Sad, Confused, Evangeline Lilly, from Lost and the Hobbit to Ant-Man and the Wasp. Hey guys, I'm Josh Horowitz, and welcome to another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. We have the very talented star of Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantum Mania, to be precise. Evangeline Lilly is on the show today, a first-time guest on the podcast. I'm actually kind of shocked she is. I was sure she had been on the podcast. This is what happens after you've been doing the pod for 9 years. It all just starts to bleed together. The MTV interviews, the Comedy Central interviews, the moderating events. My mind is just starting to become a giant amorphous blob of interview knowledge, or lack thereof. Suffice it to say, Evangeline has not been on the podcast, and I was thrilled to have her on. She's somebody that I've known in different capacities over the years, and to finally sit down with her for an extended chat about her life and career, just a blast. Before we get to the main event, though, other things to mention. Well, it's been a busy time in Josh Horowitz's Happy, Sad, Confused world. We did basically back-to-back live events with 92NY. You know I love these events, guys. And if you are in the New York area ever, please try and come out because, man, these are fun. We did Marc Maron last week. It was actually at the Museum of Modern Art, even though it was a 92NY event. Semantics, doesn't matter. And then we did a sold-out 92NY event with the cast of Star Trek Picard. And if you're already feeling FOMO, don't worry. That will be a podcast very soon. I think we have it on the books for next week, actually. So very soon. And man, that was a magical night. But we'll talk about that later. But suffice it to say, sold out. Patrick Stewart and company. Wow. Big moment. Yeah, other things to mention. I don't know. It's a busy, weird time of year. We're kind of in that kind of like slowish period, if there is one, as we careen towards the Oscars. It felt like I was like in awards mode for like 2 or 3 months, and now it's like, oh wait, we still have another month or so to go before the Oscars. So there's kind of a little anticlimactic vibe I'm feeling. Like, I caught up on all the Oscar movies a while ago, and I guess everyone else is starting to now. Like, that's the weird like cadence of my job versus, I guess, the outside world. Is like, I see stuff so early, and then it's like, wait, Women Talking is just coming out now? I was talking about that 4 months ago, so I apologize if I sound obnoxious when I'm like, you guys gotta see Women Talking in September, when it's 3 months before it comes out. But all I can do is live my life and tell you what I'm seeing and loving. So suffice it to say, you should see Women Talking. You should see Tar. You should see Fablemans. You should see Everything Everywhere All at Once. These are all great movies. I'm not going to say you have to see Top Gun Maverick, because you've seen Top Gun Maverick. By the way, I went to a movie theater, paid for the tickets like a normal human being, bought the, what did I buy? I almost did Red Vines. You know what? I went with the Rice Krispie treat. It seemed like the option that was going to be least likely to kill me. And I went to see Avatar. It was kind of a goodbye to one of my favorite theaters in New York City, one that I have a lot of affection for, the Union Square. I think it's a Regal. Multiplex is closing. I don't get it, guys. New York City, all our movie theaters are closing. The Ziegfeld closed a few years ago. The Lincoln Plaza Cinemas closed a few years ago. There are like no theaters left. There's nowhere to go see movies. We still have Lincoln Square, which is one that is important to me from growing up. But it bums me out. And I know LA's faced the same thing with the ArcLight, but I guess it's just a sign of the times. Anyway, all of which is to say, I wanted to go one more time to Union Square, to that theater, and bid it adieu. And I did it by seeing Avatar: The Way of Water, which was, again, fantastic. My third go-around, and I love that movie. And I'm sure you guys feel the same way. You have, like, movie theaters that you grew up with, that you have affection for, that you associate with specific memories, and I have so many. So, anyway, it's important to mark these moments and say goodbye, if you can, to the places that mean a lot to you. So that's what I did. I I went and I paid homage to the Union Square movie theater gods. Other things to mention, not much. I guess I'll mention, as always, you can watch our episodes on YouTube. The channel continues to grow. I'm so thrilled with how quickly it's grown. YouTube.com/Josh Horowitz. Please give it a like and subscribe. Check out our Patreon, because it's such a nice, cool community. I've gotten a chance to meet a bunch of the Patreon members recently. And they're awesome. They're good people. It makes me so happy that, like, the fans of Happy Sad Confused are like-minded in the best possible way. It doesn't mean, like, we all, whatever, are the same people, but, like, they love pop culture and movies and TV and actors and filmmakers, and it's just, like, all good vibes when I meet them. So, anyway, patreon.com/happysadconfused. We've got the merch. We've got the early access, the videos, the free tickets to the events if you sign up to the executive producer level. We've got, I think, 7 spots left in the executive producer tier. So get in on that, guys. Now's the time. I guess that's it. Let's get to the main event. Not so much of a preamble today, but that's okay, because you're really here for the conversation. Evangeline Lilly. Okay, so in brief, Evangeline is fantastic. A really good interview, because she kind of doesn't give an F. Like, she, in the best way, she will say what is on her mind, and it's gotten her this far. And it's really remarkable to look at the career that she has, because she's worked steadily since Lost. Lost was essentially her first acting role. Crazy to think. And she didn't even have, like, acting aspirations. Again, crazy story. Lost, The Hobbit, and now the Ant-Man film. She has these 3 crazy, ginormous fandoms in a career that doesn't have a lot of other stuff to it, to be honest. Like, she's done some other bits and bobs here, but, like, the ratio of the big stuff to other stuff is crazy. She was also in Real Steel, which, frankly, was a huge movie that people loved. So, she's fantastic. We talk about it all in this conversation. As she said at the end, like, we went a little, you know, a little more thoughtful, a little more deep than we usually do. We usually have sillier conversations. So I'm glad, don't worry, there are laughs in here too, but I'm glad I had a chance to catch up with her. The new movie, of course, is Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania. It's the 3rd in the Ant-Man trilogy, again, directed by Peyton Reed. It is a big, wild movie, guys. It's interesting, because it's kind of the juxtaposition of that family story that you know, the Scott Lang and his daughter Cassie, and now Hope in the family, and Hope's parents. So it has that family dynamic, but the setting is the quantum realm. I mean, we're no spoilers, but you're not in normal Earth for much time in this. You're in the quantum realm, and that is a trippy, crazy place to be for 90% of a movie. But it's anchored by these great characters and performances, and then you throw in, guys, Jonathan Majors. He's the real deal. This guy's amazing, and he may or may not be on the podcast soon. There's a little tease for you. And the only other thing I'll say is, as a old time Michelle Pfeiffer fan from back in the day, she's got a lot to do in this, and it really pleased me. It made me very happy. Michelle Pfeiffer kind of owns the first half of the movie. So anyway, no spoilers. I didn't spoil anything. Don't worry. Go in, enjoy. It's a fun, wild Marvel movie. Checks all the boxes. You'll dig it. And you'll dig this conversation. I got a chance to meet up with Evangeline in person in New York City, and it's fantastic. I hope you guys enjoy. Remember to review, give a rating on iTunes to Happy Sad Confused. Spread the good word. Follow me on social media, Joshua Horowitz, and enjoy this conversation with the star of Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania, Evangeline Lilly. Evangeline, first time guest on the podcast. I'm actually shocked. Again, we've done this so many different ways, but never officially on the podcast. So welcome.
Well, podcasts are the new thing now.
They're the hot thing.
I mean, the last time I was doing the rounds with a film, I don't think anybody was listening to podcasts.
Yeah, radio is back, apparently. We just call it podcasts now.
Yeah, exactly. kind of exciting if you think about it, because it means that people aren't requiring so much stimulation. But they're willing to actually just listen to voices who have something to say.
We say that as we shoot this on camera, too. So it's basically a lie.
Yeah. We've learned a lot already, actually.
We were saying when you walked in, it's always fun to see somebody at different stages in the journey. And this is another exciting moment with Quantumania coming out. I saw you very briefly a couple months ago. You gave me like one of the fun, like silly moments in the last couple of years where I was talking to Kobe Smulders at Comic-Con. And you interview bombed.
I love interview bombing.
You're good at it, clearly.
Well, I think I'm actually terrible at it because instead of bombing, I just took over.
No,
I was. I actually kicked her out of her own interview.
We were fading. It was over.
Oh, I didn't feel it.
It was a hot toss.
You guys were in fifth gear.
No.
Nope. All the way to the end line, and I just cut right in.
No, you should not feel that way. It was a glorious moment. But it reminds me that, look, you have a long lineage with Comic-Con, for instance. Mm-hmm. So let's start there, because that was probably, I would guess, early on in the Lost years, like that was probably a big moment where you were like, oh, I'm in a whole new stratosphere. I'm in a weird, exciting new world. Like, do you remember early Comic-Cons?
The first Comic-Con I ever went to was San Diego Comic-Con. And it was in 2005. Before the first episode of Lost ever even aired.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And we had a cult following already. We filled one of those massive 3,000 people auditoriums and nobody had even seen the show. And I was like, oh, first of all, where am I?
Yeah.
And who?
Which is the proper response, by the way.
And second of all, what have I gotten myself into?
Mm-hmm.
That was actually when I perfected my signature, because for the first time in my life, I had to sign it about 600 times in a row.
Yeah.
Where I stood between Dominic Monaghan and Matthew Fox and did a poster signing.
Yeah.
And I was very competitive back then. I was a competitive young woman. And so I turned the whole thing into a competition of like who would be waiting for who.
Oh, I love it.
Signature was slower than whose.
Yep.
And my signature got very simple and very sloppy in one Comic-Con visit, and it stayed that way ever since.
Just went to EL as opposed to the whole. I mean, that's a long name to write out. Let's be real.
Yeah, Evangeline had to go.
Yeah.
It's E. Lily.
Yep. But it does strike me, look, I mean, you have been associated with these franchises, these fandoms that have such passion behind them. Mm-hmm. And like, that's a lot of love and energy to receive. Early on, was it kind of like as exciting as it was? Is that, I mean, that can spawn like, I don't know, I feel like I'd feel a panic attack if I was like feeling that kind of energy coming at me with no experience.
I did. In fact, I don't think back then panic attacks were a buzzword yet, right? Like nobody was
really undiagnosed panic attacks,
But I can say that on my first press tour for the show, after the first season, we did New York up front, and then I went on to Europe. And before I went on to Europe, I had this meltdown in a hotel room in New York. I called my parents sobbing in a bathtub. I mean, it was really something straight out of a great movie. And I was just like, I just want to go home.
Yeah.
I just want to go home. I don't want to do this anymore. I hate it. I don't want to do this. It was really overwhelming. And of course, my parents, being good rural Canadian parents, were like, you just come home right now. Screw those guys. You come home and we'll make you some chicken noodle soup. I will take care of you. And I was like, I don't think it works that way. I think I have a 6-year contract.
Amazing. So over the years, has that gotten easier? What's the adaptation process to that? Because clearly you're not in the bathtub sobbing now.
Well, not every day anyway.
I mean, outside this morning, obviously.
It's completely different now.
Yeah.
For sure. It's an interesting thing to be able to say I've gotten used to it. So when being in the MCU, what I get asked about a lot is the fandom and how crazy is it and what was the adjustment period like for you to, you know, get used to that. And for me, I feel like it's such a weird answer to say like, oh, it didn't faze me.
Yeah.
You know, I've sort of, this has been 20 years of this. This is who my fans are. I am, like, for lack of a better way of putting it, like a Comic-Con queen, you know? That's, I spend a lot of time at Comic-Cons to, you know, go and see my fans and the people who love these franchises and are passionate about them, and they have given me a beautiful career. And so I've relaxed about it. I feel way more at ease with fan attention.
Right.
I've even, and this is a very recent development, just I would say in the last couple years, I've started to finally get comfortable with fame. That took me 20 years. That took a long time.
So what, parse that out for me a little bit. So what does that mean?
Well, it just, for me, I always had this resistance because I kept wanting to somehow translate to people, I'm just like you. I'm a normal person. Like, please don't treat me any differently or think of me any differently. That's an inappropriate placement of your energy.
Yes.
And I finally just gave up and was like, you know what? If people have you on a pedestal and then you show up and you kick the pedestal down.
Right. You're diminishing their own.
Yeah. You're actually not. Who are you helping? What is that doing? And what is that saying about your self-worth?
Yep.
Like that you don't actually believe that you're good enough or in some way like special to be able to be put on a pedestal. Like, right. Let's examine that and say, do you not have like 100 million hearts of love to give these people? Like, that's something I've always felt.
Yeah.
So is that not pedestal worthy? Like, can't you find the things about yourself that you could flaunt, that you could strut about, that you could like do the starlit walk or like give them what they're looking for? They want you to be something that if you dig deep enough, you realize you have self-faith. Like, I believe in myself. Why can't I just own that and accept it?
Well, and we're talking about, which often comes up in my conversations with folks, which is imposter syndrome, which is real for all of us, I feel like. And anyone worth their salt, I always say, has it. Like, if you don't have it, then, like, I'm worried about
you. Oh, phew, because I've got it in spades, so I'm okay.
No, but what you're saying is, like, finding a healthy balance, I think, between still having that and, yes, realizing, like, you're still Evangeline from Alberta, et cetera, but, like, that you can also play the part and have the self-worth and know what you bring to a role and bring to your career that is of worth to people.
Yes. And also to remember that, like, Nicole Evangeline Lilly in Alberta always felt like there was something special about her, mm-hmm. and that somehow it wasn't like that she was destined for something.
Yeah.
But then the minute that happens, it's like, oh, what, me? No, I'm just, you know, that's ridiculous. I'm just a normal person. Like, can there be a balance and can there be a dance between those two things? And can I have the humility and the grace to know that I am just like you and therefore not have to lord over you or put myself above you?
Yeah.
But then also the self-love and the respect for your adoration of me to acknowledge it and make space for it and allow for it.
There's also, I would guess, like, again, if we were talking in the lost years, that was like a crazy phenomenon and it was right out of the gate. It was basically the first acting gig, essentially. Yeah. And then, like, you know, with the passage of time now, it's like, oh, you're not a one-trick pony. We've done The Hobbit. We've done three Ant-Man films. Like, your ratio of, like, franchises, beloved films and TV projects to just like your entire body of work is insane.
It's ridiculous. But I attribute that to J.J. Abrams and Brian Burke and Damon Lindelof, because by putting me in that cult phenomenon at the very onset of my career, I feel like they set the stage for this, because then the folks who loved Lost within the industry are the type of folks who are making these geek fandom franchises. And they were like, we loved Freckles, right? And then Freckles put me in the position to be Tauriel, and then Freckles and Tauriel put me in the position to be, I think actually as the story goes, where the idea for me to play the Wasp came from, or Hope Van Dyne, was that Edgar Wright and Brad Winterbaum were watching The Hobbit while they were prepping this movie, and all of a sudden the penny dropped and one of them was like, oh my God, Evangeline Lilly for this part, right? Yeah. And so it feeds into itself.
It makes sense. So, okay, so talk to me a little bit about, I know the famous story for those who don't know is that basically there wasn't like a giant acting career prior to Lost. In fact, you really weren't that interested in an acting career at all. So give me a sense of, okay, you get the part, the learning curve on that set.
Mm.
Like, when you think back to the first weeks on that, like, did you know where your mark was? Like, did you know how, like,
when I think back to the first weeks, I feel sick to my stomach. Yeah. I still have that sick feeling. It was very, very intense. I didn't even know how to read a call sheet to know when I was supposed to arrive at work. I didn't know where I was supposed to go. I didn't know. And then there were little things like ADs always opening my car door for me. I got really annoyed. I was like, stop it. What are you doing? I'm not the queen. Like, let me open my door. Stuff that was like really distracting from what I was really there to do.
Yeah.
And then on top of it, I I mean, I'd never had to do 10 takes of the same scene and keep it fresh. I'd never had to try to take direction in six different ways. I mean, I'd never done any of this. So I was using my co-stars as my teachers.
Right.
I would watch them. And you're never supposed to do this in a scene. You're supposed to be present. But I would watch them and be mentally taking notes. Like, oh, Terry Quinn just did that really cool thing. I gotta remember how to do that. Or like, you know, Harold Perrineau is just so present, and like there's just different things that I picked up from each of them, and that continues on to this day. I mean, yeah. I just got to do a film with Michelle Pfeiffer. Like, talk about an education. You know, she's amazing.
So when you do have occasion to stumble upon early work in Lost, like, are you seeing, because your performance is fantastic, and maybe I don't know. Is there something that's maybe just like raw and just sort of like you weren't overthinking it that was working? Or are you, it sounds like you're critical of it. You see kind of the motors moving or what?
I feel like the raw magic is what people received.
Yes.
It is not what I was seeing. we would have Lost parties where the cast would get together to watch the show. And when it would be a Kate-centric episode, I would want to curl in a hole and die because I knew I was bad. And I still to this day will stand by the fact that I can watch the first couple seasons and I cringe because I'm not very good. And I do feel like season three was a turning point where I went from panic, figure it out, just shoot from the hip, feel it, go with my gut, to I hate this, I don't want to do this, get me out of here. To, oh, I guess if I'm here and I'm stuck and I'm gonna stay, I should figure it out.
Right.
And that was in season three. And I started to actually try to, learn my craft.
Can you give me a high point of like the absurd cultural zeitgeisty moment of Lost? Like I don't know if it was a Rolling Stone Annie Leibovitz shoot or like something insane that felt like, okay, we're now in bananas territory.
Yeah, only I can only know those things by looking back in hindsight, because at the time I wasn't a cinephile. I wasn't a kid who read magazines. I knew nothing about Hollywood. I didn't watch Entertainment Tonight or anything to sort of cue me off to what was in the cultural zeitgeist.
Yeah.
So when I was offered a Rolling Stone cover, I had no idea how bloody cool that was. In hindsight, I'm like, holy shit, I was on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine. But that didn't mean much to me at the time. I mean, it was like, okay, sure, whatever I got to do for my job. Or, you know, I did a Cool Water endorsement campaign and Peter Lindenberg shot it. And everyone was freaking out. My makeup artist was like, oh, it's Peter Lindenberg. Oh my God, I can't believe it. And I was like, who? I don't care. Just, I was annoyed that I had to be in a bathing suit. I was annoyed that it was a sexualized suit and shoot. And I just was mad at everyone for being there and being a part of it. There were the fan things. Like one time Dominic Monaghan and I were out for dinner in Europe somewhere. And there was a lineup to our dinner table at the restaurant of people wanting to take pictures and get autographs. They lined up. And I was like, what is going on? I'm just trying to have dinner.
Well, guys, I don't know about you, but these cold winter nights make me appreciate all the more a product like Boll and Branch. These sheets are keeping me warm and cozy all winter long with a set of their buttery soft sheets. They're made with 100% organic cotton threads that get softer with every wash. And they come in a variety of great colors. My wife and I love this product. The sheets feel great. They look great. They make great gifts. It just checks all the boxes. Plus, these sheets are designed to feel incredible for every kind of sleeper, and they're made without toxins. They're free from pesticides, formaldehyde, and other harsh chemicals. And these sheets fit the deepest of mattresses and are labeled with top and bottom tags, so making your bed is easier than ever. They come in 10 versatile colors in all sizes, from twin up to California King. And best of all, Boll & Branch gives you a 30-night risk-free guarantee, guys, with free shipping and returns on all U.S. orders. What more do I have to say? How important is sleep to you and your loved ones? It's everything to me. That's what Boll & Branch can mean to you. So make the most of bedtime with Boll & Branch sheets. Get 15% off your first order when you use promo code HSC at bollandbranch.com. Exclusions apply. See site for details. That's Boll & Branch, BOLLANDBRANCH.com, promo code HSC. we were talking before about, you know, like finding your own self-worth and kind of owning it. In the course of those, I guess, about 6 years or so, like, did you also like find a voice on set at a certain point? Because again, early on, you probably don't even know you have a voice and know you're entitled to it.
Yeah. I'm still working on that. That has come with middle age. So something shifted in me when I turned 40 and, you know, in the years surrounding it, where there was, first of all, there was a cultural shift because of the Me Too Time's Up movement that had a profound impact on me. And then also I was just in that stage of life where I'm shifting into a different space, and it's really helped to empower me. And on Ant-Man and the Wasp Quantumania, I feel like that was the first time that I ever really made my voice heard in a creative and collaborative capacity, as opposed to trying to make my voice heard. And there's a very big difference. And up until that one, I don't feel that I had ever succeeded. And it was incredibly rewarding and very, very satisfying to feel like, okay, I'm a grown woman and I'm finally being heard.
Yeah, and my character's name is in the title. I deserve probably a little to weigh in a little bit.
You hope. You hope. But so much of that is on them and so much of that is on you. And one of the things I used to do is I would cut myself off at the knees before I even started.
Right.
I would come in with an idea, and instead of saying, hey guys, I have this really great idea, let's talk about it, I would be like, this is probably a really dumb idea. You probably won't like it and you probably won't use it, but right, I just want to say it anyway. Like, I would just always, you know, I didn't have that self-assurance to come in and say in my head, they might not like it, but I think it's a great idea, so I'm going to represent it as such.
Yep.
And properly represent myself.
So is there an example you can cite in terms of something that you brought to the table for Quantumania specifically that they actually received and absorbed into?
Yeah, well, I mean, production? It's sort of interesting because what's being received and absorbed during production has nothing to do with what will actually happen in the editing room and what the movie will turn out to be.
Sure.
They're very separated events.
Yes.
So when I first got the script, I had lots of notes and lots of thoughts. It was a fantastic script. It was the best sort of standing script I'd ever read for Ant-Man, because often they're not quite finished when you read them.
Yep.
This one was really good. I still had lots of notes. I still had, you know, some suggestions and things I wanted to point out and an offer. And when I got on that Zoom, instead of having a private conversation with somebody, I actually said, I'd like the producer, Stephen Broussard, I'd like the writer, Jeff Loveness, I'd like Peyton Reed, and I'd like to have a conversation, because I felt like that's my best shot at being heard.
Yes.
Because if it's one-on-one, it's just that person's opinion versus yours.
Right.
And they probably have their own ideas and their own visions already kind of set in stone. As soon as it's a group dynamic, it's much more collaborative by nature.
Yeah.
And it really worked. And I felt like it was wonderful, because one of those men might say, God, that's a really smart idea, thank you. And I could see it impact the other two and the way they were thinking about what I was saying. And then suddenly, like, it started to flow.
Right.
Instead of it being just like three people listening to me, it became a fluid conversation that felt really exciting and mutual.
Does that also go hand in hand with the other creative endeavors in recent years? And we've talked before, and I know the Squicker Wonkers books is something that's close to your heart. And I heard you in another conversation saying you were writing a TV project. I don't know if that is Squicker Wonkers or something else.
Yes.
But I would think that all goes hand in hand. Like, you're not a hired gun anymore. You are thinking of all the parts.
Yeah, I really am. And I think that's one of the things I had to really acknowledge was just, hey, listen, like, look at what's happening. You're getting very frustrated creatively.
Yeah.
So instead of bringing that frustration to a role and to a poor director who's going to be subjected to your creative ideas that are like not necessarily appropriate for his film, why don't you just make your own stuff?
Yeah.
Like, that's, you got to put that somewhere, because if you don't put that somewhere, you're going to keep bringing that frustration to acting. And as we all know, or at least, you know, I don't know if your listeners know, but I've been a somewhat reluctant actress for my entire career. Yeah. I've retired thrice in the 20 years I've been in this industry.
She's the Daniel Day-Lewis of super heroines.
Somebody else said that about, they were saying, you're the Tom Brady of Hollywood.
Amazing.
You just keep retiring and coming back and retiring and coming
back. It more dramatic, though, every time she's back.
Well, it was like, I got to stop telling people that I think I've retired, because it's going to seem like it's just a bit, exactly.
Yeah.
So I've stopped saying it.
Okay.
But because, you know, that's always been there. And I think that's always partly been there because my first passion was writing.
Yeah.
And acting was something that just happened. And if, in order to survive the trials of acting, it is a very difficult profession on many different levels. You have to love it. it has to be your passion or it will eat you alive. And so I think what I'm just doing is making sure that I'm finding outlets to express all the other things that I actually love to do more.
Well, not to mention, and I'm sure the early experiences, and when I say that, I mean even prior to Lost, must have made you a bit jaded. Like, I was looking up just sort of seeing early stuff, and I found like a G4 kind of thing where you're essentially like modeling like a...
Oh, yes. Oh, God. Talk about degrading.
Yeah, you must have felt like a Price is Right commercial.
No, I mean, watching them back even, I kind of get like that cringy, like gross feeling in my tummy because I'm like, ew. I was cute and I was young and they got me like a little pop top and low rise jeans and like I'm hawking gaming gear.
Yep.
Yeah, I was very jaded going into it because I wasn't even going into it with the hopes of becoming a famous actress. I was going into it with the hopes of paying my way through university. And then I felt like I had to kind of degrade myself to do that. So I had a very bad taste in my mouth about the whole acting business, period. Right. But that's because I was in the lowest end of it. I mean, doing extra work in commercials isn't exactly... glamorous.
Totally. Okay, so back into the chronology a little bit. We were talking Lost, and we'll come back to the Ant-Man films, but after Lost, one of the first retirements happens, I think.
That's right. Nailed it. Yes. Right after Real Steel. I did Lost, and then I did Real Steel right on the tail end of the sixth season of Lost. And when we did reshoots for Real Steel, I was pregnant with my first baby, and I was like, I'm done.
Can we mention Real Steel, though, for a second? Because there's so much love for that film still. And it's a great film. Sean Levy, the nicest man on the planet.
The nicest man on the planet.
Like, insane director, and now of Stranger Things, making a Star Wars movie, apparently. I don't know, Evangeline, you might want to hit up your old friend.
Oh, yeah, right? When Brian Burke and J.J. Abrams first did Star Wars, I reached out to Brian. I was like, I want to be Leia. He was like, well, Leia's going to be Leia. I was like, oh, okay, I get it. Carrie Fisher, all right.
Worth another shot, though, with Sean.
Well,
not for
I'll tell
Leia,
you what.
But...
I'll tell you what. Even though I am in retirement again, if there was a project that would pull me out, it would be a Sean Levy project.
Yeah.
He's such a wonderful director, and life's too short to work with anyone that isn't wonderful, and I'm way too old to waste my time on people who are assholes. And so I would be there for Sean. I mean, I really have a very special place in my heart for him. He was a wonderful person to work with.
Apparently, they're finally at least doing something with the Real Steel thing. I think they're doing a Disney Plus show, but I assume that's not has nothing to do with your characters or anything. It's a new thing.
I don't think it does. I know that there was this sort of oopsie moment with Real Steel when they realized that they marketed the movie completely wrong, and if they had marketed it appropriately, it probably would have had a sequel because it would have had a huge following. Because eventually, once the right audience found it on the streaming platforms, which is families, not testosterone driven young boys, then it became a cult classic. There is a huge following for it now. So yeah, I haven't heard about the TV show, but I don't know what it is, but I'm not involved.
Okay, so before Ant-Man, as I recall, you were either fan casted or real casted in other superhero kind of stuff. Like, there was even talk that you, like, true or false, did you meet with like a Joss Whedon about a Wonder Woman project?
Yep, that happened.
Mm-hmm. How did that go? Was that a real thing? Did it feel like a real thing at the time?
It felt like a real thing, but I have no idea. You'd have to ask Joss, but I think my impression coming away from it was I had no desire and he could tell.
Were you trying to fake it, or not even?
I was too young to be that polite.
Why were you not into it? Just in the idea of playing Wonder Woman wasn't at that point didn't make sense.
It didn't appeal, and there was nothing about the meeting that like jazzed me or made me think like, oh, I gotta do this. Nothing clicked, nothing felt good, and I think that I at that time, and still I think to this day, I am way too authentic for my own good.
Right.
I mean, it's not good. If I am not impressed, you'll know. And maybe you shouldn't know sometimes. And I think there was maybe even a little bit of like offense taken.
Right. Like you should be excited. We're saying you could be Wonder
exactly.
Woman. Shouldn't you be excited? And you're like, I'm good.
I'm not really. Yeah. You know, and that I was okay with that. I was okay with burning bridges. I was okay with not having everyone in Hollywood just, you know, want to work with me and think everything, you know, I was okay. I was like, I'm good. I'm doing Lost. I'm great. And then there were a couple other, like, I don't know it's weird talking about stuff that has come your way that you've passed up on, because then I don't know, like, does it put the person who offered you in a weird position or make it sound, I don't know. It just sounds braggy.
It's fine.
You're own like, it. Just
we said
tell
own it.
Me.
Remember,
just
own
tell
your
me.
Worth, Evangeline.
Okay. Well, I don't know if I'm supposed to say this. I guess it doesn't matter. What are the consequences? When we were working on Real Steel, Hugh Jackman was like, hey, so the X-Men guys are like asking me if I would approach you because they know that you won't talk to anybody and won't do anything and you're not reading scripts and no one can reach you. So they knew I was working with you and just were interested to know if it would ever interest you to maybe do an X-Men thing. And I was like, no, not. It doesn't wow. interest me. I'm not interested.
Playing hard to get. It's working.
And then, well, then I felt like, I was like, this feels like, I feel like such a dick because I'm talking to an X-Men.
Right, the X-Men.
The X, like, he's, and I'm telling him, no, that doesn't appeal. Like, what? I felt
I don't
so
see
rude.
It. I don't see it, Hugh. I don't know what you get out
yeah.
of it. Yeah.
Why would you do that? What were you thinking? You know? Well, I mean, come on.
It's a weird thing. But look, yeah. you got to just stay true to yourself.
That's exactly it.
Yeah.
I just always had to do what felt right for me.
Well, and also, you don't want to be in, it's like locked into five movies with a character and a franchise you're not passionate about.
Totally.
Which can happen.
And honestly, I wasn't into superhero movies. And that's the main reason why in both of these instances, I just kind of felt like, I don't know what I get out of this because I don't like watching those movies. They don't right. appeal to me. And I often was very critical of them. Like I was known to mock them and treat them as like lower forms of entertainment until Marvel came around.
Yeah.
And when they approached, I had the same reaction. You know, I'm equal. I'm fair in my negativity. my disdain for superhero movies. I was like, no, not interested. No, thank you. To my manager, not to them. Yeah. You know, just talking to him about it. And he was like, have you seen any Marvel movies? And I was like, no, of course not. Why would I watch that? And he's like, you should see them. And when I did, I was like, oh, they're doing something very different and very cool.
So then when you get the role of Hope and then Edgar leaves the project, you're like, oh, see? I told you, guys. What are we doing here? Why?
Yes.
You convinced me to do this, and now
oh, yes. I was ready to walk. I was like, oh, this big corporate giant's bullying the creatives. Forget it. Creatives band together. I'm going. You know, right. I wasn't keen on that. And I was really excited to work with Edgar. And I thought Edgar yeah. and Paul would have been just such a great dynamic duo. And Edgar had a very different vision for Hope than we ended up ultimately, you know, going with. He had a really like sort of dark, like mole, what's that called? Double agent type thing. Yeah. And he wanted to do it in classic Edgar style, which was like wigs and, you know, different looks. And I was like, this is going to be really fun.
Yeah.
So yeah, I did have that moment of like, see, this is why you say no to the big franchises.
Well, then luckily they get someone like Peyton, who is, again, kind of that Sean Levy school of just like smart yeah. and nice and cool
yes.
and inventive. Was it, what reassured you when he came on board? Was it the next iteration of the script? Was it a conversation with him?
It was the next iteration of the script. For me, everything lives and breathes with the writing and the script, which is hard in a Marvel film because it's changing the whole way
sure.
through. But if what is happening in the story is ultimately being serviced by whatever decision is being made, like I think that Edgar Wright's Ant-Man would have been phenomenal
sure.
and I would have killed to be a part of it. Yeah. But you know, if Marvel have a vision for their MCU and it has to fit into the MCU, like there's that whole thing of like, how do you do that? How do you manage that? And how do you keep everything sort of monochromatic in a way while still having variation? And they're good at that. I think they're good at having an overarching feeling so that you know you're in the same universe,
yep.
you understand the concept, while also having each franchise have its own personality. So, you know, I think I was convinced, you know, by the end I was like, okay, I get it. I see what you're doing.
So you make the first two Ant-Man and the Wasp films. And I think maybe after that, is that when the Endgame moment happens,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Which I've heard you talk about and makes sense to me. It's like you kind of walk into that scene, those scenes, kind of like, where am I? What movie am I in? Because that's...
Totally.
So when you saw that movie, were you like, oh, that's the movie I was in? Like, did you even have any sense of it?
I had no sense of it. And I saw that movie and I was like, oh, that's the scene I was in, let alone the movie I was in, because I had no idea what the scene was. And I was like, and you can really tell I have no idea what I'm doing or where I am. It was so like, I feel like I just stood out like a sore thumb in the not being seamless with the rest of the
even
the cast.
What you mean,
in
like in the moment with the other women, like even like the swaggering moment? I feel like you guys all make sense together as that team.
I loved that moment, and yeah. shooting that moment, there was such a camaraderie in and amongst ourselves, I did feel really at home in that moment. Actually, that moment felt really good and really fun. It was more the coming out of the portal. Was it a portal?
It was a portal.
See, I don't even know what I came out of. I was so lost. And I come out and I look around and I was like, yeah, that's how I felt. Like, where am I? What's going on? What is this movie?
Were they just like catching you on a hidden camera being like, okay, come out of her trailer. Yeah, we'll get her.
Exactly. She'll be confused. Just make sure she's in costume.
So were you mentioned that great moment with all these amazing female cast members that had such great intentions, and then a lot of people interpreted it as kind of a pandering moment. And did that bum you out when it was kind of like, it felt like, that's clearly not what you were trying to do. And if anything, it was trying to be the opposite of that.
I think that it can happen in service of like the big picture. I think that there is really good intentions a lot of the time. Well, all the time. I think there's really good intentions with the decisions that are being made for, you know, representation. But there's like a formula for these stories, and it's really hard to break the formula. So I think that in creating the film, it can fall prey to these moments losing some of their meaning and becoming a little bit superficial.
Right.
And I think what would help is the more and more we have space and room for that to be justified, like for these women to come together in organic ways and have any kind of relationship or any kind of engagement. Like for me, one of the most heroic feminist moments in Marvel film was that moment when we're testing my Marvel knowledge.
There's a portal.
And then there's no portal involved. Okay, there was a ditch. There's a ditch involved.
Okay.
And it was Black Widow, and I think it was Scarlet Witch was being really, like, she was at her last legs. She was fighting in the battle. I think it was either Endgame or the one right before that, which Infinity War. Yep. And
there'll be a test later. But yes,
thank you. Actually, if you could give me the cheat sheet now, sure, no so problem. I can study. And she's about to be killed.
Right.
And the bad guy says something about like, oh, your friends aren't here to like defend you, like you're alone. And then I think Black Widow steps up and is like, but she's not alone. and in that moment in the theater, I literally leapt out of my seat and screamed at the top of my lungs. I was like, yeah. And I had this fierce moment of that feeling of knowing what it feels like to be a woman at the hands of powerful men and feeling very alone and unrepresented and like undefended. And then it was like in that moment, Scarlett was there at my back in all of those moments of my life being like, fuck you. I was like, tell him, Scarlett, you tell him. I was so into it. It really, that one hit for me.
Yeah.
That one felt really powerful.
For most of us, learning a second language in high school or college was not exactly a high point in our academic careers. I know it wasn't for me. I tried Italian, I tried French, and none of it stuck. But now, thanks to Babbel, the language learning app that sold more than 10 million subscriptions, there's an addictively fun and easy way to learn a new language. Whether you'll be traveling abroad, connecting in a deeper way with family, or you just have some free time, Babbel teaches bite-sized language lessons that you'll actually use in the real world. I'm doing Italian because I love to travel, and I love going to Italy, and I want to engage the culture in a little bit of a more profound and meaningful way. And yeah, I want to be able to order better in Italian restaurants, okay? Babbel's 15-minute lessons make it the perfect way to learn a new lesson and language on the go. Other language learning apps use AI for their lesson plans, but Babbel lessons were created by over 100 language experts. Plus, you can choose from over 14 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, and German. There's so many ways to learn with Babbel. They've got lessons that you can access, podcasts, games, videos, stories, and even live classes. Plus, it comes with a 20-day money-back guarantee. Right now, when you purchase a 3-month Babbel subscription, you'll get an additional 3 months for free, guys. That's 6 months for the price of 3. Just go to babbel.com and use promo code HSC. That's BABBEL.com, code HSC. Let's talk a little Quantumania. This is a bananas movie. I mean, that is a high compliment. It's a big, crazy world that we're introduced to. And yet it's still this great family at its core, and it's an emotional story. And then you throw in
Jonathan Majors, who's just like, oh my God, the greatest new actor on the scene, fantastic. When you read this script, like, what does the script read like? Does it read like, I don't know, like, can you make heads or tails of it, given like all the descriptions and the bizarre?
Do you know what's strange? Yeah. Is the script reads much more straightforward than the film itself. When I saw the film, I was like, this is, like you said, this is bananas. Yeah. It's kooky and zany and all over the place and like, wow, what is going on? Does it feel like that? The script felt very clean and very clear and very like straightforward. And I was like, ooh, I can follow this. Not all Marvel films are easy to follow. They're like you said, there's so much action and there's mythology and there's so many things going on. So yeah, the script was not like that.
Okay.
But it's not because they've changed it a lot from the script. It's just something happens in the translation on screen.
Well, you're also probably, I mean, you can almost like skip the descriptive stuff and just go straight to the dialogue, which tells the story.
Right.
And there's like probably these giant chunks of like description of these crazy banana worlds.
Which I'm going to admit, I totally skip.
Yeah. Like, why do you need to know that?
Like all the time.
You guys do your thing. Yeah, I'll do my thing.
Exactly.
Okay. So talk to me about... We talked about Michelle Pfeiffer last time I saw you for Ant-Man and the Wasp. Part of one of the reasons I love this film is there's so much Michelle in this.
Oh, like, me
she's so,
too.
And she's so good. It's like,
she's always so good, and she's just so good to look at. And I hate to say that. That's so degrading, but it's true. She's so beautiful. She's a model. And she's so good in it. And I felt the same. I was so happy to see
it. Do you feel like, because I mean, I remember when I spoke to you for the last film, there was almost still like an intimidation factor a little bit of like, yes, like I can talk to her, but like they're still like putting her on a pedestal a little bit.
Yeah.
Has that diminished a little bit, or is it still?
It has, like in a healthy, like in a good way, not in a way that in any way she is less cool or less incredible to me, but just in the way that we got really close on this film and we were really supportive of one another. We spent a lot of time collaborating on the relationship between Janet and Hope and talking to the writers about what we wanted to see for it. And you know, these are really difficult films to make, and so she became a real comfort and a real ally. And there was like, not so much a mother-daughter thing, but a genuine friendship that developed.
Amazing. So talk to me a little bit about the ambition right now for this character. Because look, we've seen the Wasp in relation to Scott and the family. Like, could you imagine playing Hope without them? Like who is Janet, or who is Hope rather, without the family around her? Does that intrigue you?
Totally intrigues me.
Yeah.
So this thing has happened online where a fan asked a question at a press conference about whether or not there would be a standalone Wasp film coming. Okay. And I was like, I'm all for it. Kevin, what do you think? Because he was sitting right behind me. And now all of a sudden, there's headlines all over the news like Evangeline Lilly calling for a standalone Wasp movie. And I'm like, hang on. I didn't. That was a fan that was calling for it. I just said I'd be game. Exactly. Come on. But that's the kind of thing that does make that intriguing to me is just because there's never enough space in a Marvel movie to explore the character in the ways that I would want to. I mean, I'm a person who didn't like superhero movies for this very reason. Right. Like, I like character-driven pieces. I like the squid and the whale.
Yep.
You know? Yep. So I want more of that. And, you know, that's never going to happen. And the fans would not be happy if it did. If I made a Marvel movie, it would be the lowest grossing Marvel film of all time. But I do see it as an opportunity to have that time to get a little bit more into who is Hope outside of, you know, being like a trainer for Scott or being a support for Scott or being, you know, a daughter. Like, who is she? Just who is Hope?
Yeah. I'm most curious about this. Like, with like the stuff coming down the pike, like Kang Dynasty and Secret Wars, like, how does it work? Do they check in with you occasionally and be like, here's what's coming? Like,
hell no.
No, you don't. Literally like, here's when we need you.
It's like, yeah, it's like, oh, I get a call from my lawyer being like, hey, guess what? Good news. They want to make another Ant-Man and the Wasp movie. Are you available on these dates? You know, and that's it. And it won't be like, just so you know, you're launching Phase 5 and launching the Dynasty of Kang. No, just there's another movie. Would you like to do it? Here are the dates.
So, okay, if we were off camera right now, just having a drink, being casual, could you even tell me what happens like in Kang Dynasty? Do you know anything?
Zero, nothing. Not even an inkling. I know as much as anyone who watched Quantumania already knows. That's as much as I know. And I'm not saying that so that I don't spoil it. I genuinely don't know.
And is that a frustration at this point, or is that just part of the deal?
Like, oh, no, I don't mind. Fine. I don't mind at all. I don't have the time. I'm a working mom. Like, I don't have the time to keep up with the whole thing. It's huge. It's too much.
No, I relate. Look, I love this stuff, and like I'm like, it's like a full-time job for me to like keep up with, God bless Marvel, but all the content, it's like, slow down, guys, I need a second.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I kept up with half of Phase 4, which I think was pretty good for me. I did pretty well. I saw probably about half of them, but it was way too much for me to see them all. My son, my 11-year-old son, on the other hand, has seen everything
so
at least
you can,
once.
Like, yes, on him, be exactly. Like, so what's going on here?
Yes. Yeah, he picked out an Easter egg in this film that I didn't even know existed. He was like, oh, and he like saw this thing and he connected it to another one of the Marvel films. And I'm being very cryptic right now, just in case he's right. But because I think he is right, because he really knows Marvel.
So, okay, so we've been talking mostly about the acting and a little bit on the other creative pursuits like Swicker Wonkers and writing and all of that. Look, I mean, I follow you on social media and I know you a bit over the years. And I know, like, I don't know if it comes from childhood or what, but you're also very, like, socially and politically engaged. Mm-hmm. And that's something that clearly is a passionate part of your life. Does it feel like, because it's not necessarily what a big conglomerate is looking for in an actor, right?
No.
Is someone to be like, hey, here's what I think.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you ever get the call from like Feige being like, I love you, but can...
No.
No. Well, that's good.
They're very respectful. In fact, I've had direct conversations with them that I have instigated. And, you know, they've always said, like, that's not our business. That's not for us to tell you how to live your life or what opinions to have. And, you know, I actually even got a really supportive phone call from Peyton Reed at one point. And, you know, just saying, like, just so you know, there's some rumors spreading about, like, you know, Marvel ditching you or canceling you. And that didn't come from Marvel and that didn't come from us. So just ignore that.
Well, that's huge.
Yeah.
To know that they've got your back.
It's really nice. And I think it's really healthy. I think there needs to be a divide between your professional life and your personal life.
Right. Okay, so besides being a mom and doing this Marvel business, what is when you have some time, creative time, what is occupying the time right now? Are you writing another project? Are you trying to get something off the ground? Or?
I am. So I've got a couple things going. One is this film called Legend of Destruction, which we just announced in Deadline a couple days ago. We're looking for distribution in the U.S. It's an animated feature that is like none ever made before. It's 1,500 still life oil paintings that don't move, but the camera moves through the paintings. And so it's almost like reading a book that just comes to life in your mind. And for about the first 5 minutes, I think there's a bit of squirming in your seat, like, but it's not moving, I don't understand. And then all of a sudden something happens and you just switch over and the film comes to life in your mind through what's happening on screen, but it's actually not in motion. And it's about the destruction of the Second Temple of Jerusalem. And Oscar Isaac is the lead voice, and Elliot Gould and Billy Zane are in it with me, and I play Queen Bernice, and I'm just so excited about it. And I really hope we get U.S. distribution, because it's a cautionary tale about a society divided amongst themselves, which I think is really prevalent in America right now.
Amazing.
And then, go ahead. No, I could go on forever. I've got so many projects on the back burner.
Give me one more. Is it Squicker Wonkers? Is it the TV show?
I've written a feature.
Oh.
And I have a very exciting, producing partner who, I'm like, I won't tell you who, but there's this hot, young, new, like, exciting producer, director kid who wants to make it with me. And amazing. I'm very excited.
Do we need to manifest at this point another franchise, or are you good? Like, because
oh my God.
Like, are you?
Yes, we do.
You're Comic-Con queen already. But
no, we do.
You're greedy. Now you want more.
The next franchise has got to be of my creation.
There you go. That's the next. That's clearly the next step. I'm done playing with other people's sandboxes.
That's right.
My own.
That's right. I'm done being someone else's puppet. Let's bring my puppets to life on the big screen. And there's going to be 20 series or 20 books, so we could do that.
I love it. It's always great catching up with you. Congratulations. Not that folks need me to endorse it, but Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania. It's another big, fun swing from Marvel. It's a wild ride. You're excellent in it, as always. And it sounds like we'll be talking more about all these thousands of other projects.
I hope so. And this was so neat. It was very different for us. Normally, we're just being idiots together and laughing our asses off.
We'll compensate next
time.
We'll go really stupid next time.
It was really good.
We contain multitudes, Evangeline.
Yes.
We can be serious.
We can have variants. Right?
She's on brand. Look at that. thanks for the time, as always.
Thank you.
And so ends another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. Remember to review, rate, and subscribe to this show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm a big podcast person. I'm Daisy Ridley, and I definitely wasn't pushed to do this by Josh.